Good. Well, we're back in Daniel, this wonderful book that we started a couple of weeks ago. And it is a great book. And 2 weeks ago, I sort of set the background for the book. And I wouldn't recap all of that if you weren't here. You can listen. Maybe it'll be helpful to listen to that sermon online or get a copy from Rick for that sermon. But the book starts in Jerusalem and then moves swiftly to Babylon. And Jerusalem had been handed over to King Nebuchadnezzar. It was handed over to him. It's not that he took it, but it was handed over to him by God. And as we saw that time, that God was fulfilling his own word that he had spoken through the prophets, that this would come to be. And we see from this that this was divine judgment. And therefore, we today can trust the word of God very confidently, because what God has promised in the past has come to be, so what God promises in the future will come to be as well. So that's a real encouragement for us, even though we're looking here at divine judgment. And Daniel and his three friends have been taken off to Babylon. Three deportations that we saw, and they were taken off in the first one. And that's where we pick up the story tonight. They're in Babylon. This is where they've been whipped off to and taken to. And the first thing I want us to look at tonight is Daniel and his friends were faced with the challenge of being relocated to a foreign land. Daniel and his friends were faced with the challenge of being relocated to a foreign land. Now, it's very obvious when you're outside of your own country that things are different when you're outside of your own country. Often the landscape will be different. The weather will be different in different parts of the world, depending where you are. And if we're honest and face it, most countries, the weather is different to our own country, wherever you go in different parts of the world. And these things are nice in and of themselves when you're off on holiday to another land, another country, or another part of the country itself. And you come back and you're all excited and you're sharing with your friends how great a holiday you had, and then you're inviting them around for a photo slide show, and they're thinking, oh no, he's inviting me to see all the photos, or whatever it is. But there is a nice experience, isn't there, when you've been on holiday, and you do want to share that with your friends, and you say, oh yeah, you should go there if you get a chance to go there. But that's not the true reality of another country. A holiday experience is not the true reality of another country, of a foreign land. The true reality sets in another country when you're there and it's gone past the holiday period time. And you wake up one day and you say, well, this is how it is now. You're living in a country where everything seems different. The people are different. The landscape is different. The weather is different. The food is different. The mentality of the people is different. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. There's nothing wrong with it. If you live in Switzerland, the Swiss have a very strong mentality. The trains are never late other than 2 minutes. And a 2 minute train delay is considered a real delay in Switzerland. It runs wonderfully. And they have a very high sense of performance in every field in Switzerland. Now that's very, if you come from a more relaxed culture and you're there, you think, ooh, you know, a bit like that. So it's not wrong that other mentalities are different, because they're different to our own. It doesn't necessarily mean that our mentality is the supreme mentality. But you soon notice in another country how different people think and how they behave and how they react. And living in another country, as I said, the landscape is different, the weather is different, the food is different, the language is different, the culture is different, and the mentality of the people is different. Excuse me. And those are some of the challenges that missionaries are faced with. For example, when a missionary goes to another country, they're faced with all of those challenges. And when the initial sort of excitement, honeymoon period passes by and they're all fired up to serve the Lord in that country, they wake up one day and they say, well, this is it. This is it. Everything is different. The weather's different. The landscape's different. The climate is different. And they're faced with the challenges of that. And they're often faced with great mountains. Great mountains that they see. And some of them actually just can't climb those mountains, let alone have those mountains removed. They find it hard to adapt to the climate, to the food, to the language. And add to that, they're trying to share the gospel with people who are hardened, and many of them may be xenophobic as well. Add to that. And people often come back from another country, missionaries, disheartened, downcast, and they're back in their own land within 2 or 3 years. And they're depressed and wounded in different ways and damaged. And they may even be angry and frustrated and grow to deeply dislike the people that they once tried to share the gospel with. I'm saying all this and Fiona's going off. Different environment on the ship, Fiona. You'll enjoy it. Life moves very quickly. But you'll have support and people behind you and helping you, and ourselves praying for you as well. But others do manage to make it. They climb the mountains. They get familiar with the landscape, with the food, with the language, with the people, and they share Christ, and people are saved, and they have a real love for the people that they're serving there. Now, these were the challenges that Daniel and his friends are facing. But they were, of course, far worse for Daniel and his friends. It was far worse in their case. It wasn't that they were simply missionaries in Babylon who had been sent off from the tribe of Judah with prayerful Judeans praying behind them, supporting them, and then with the opportunity to return for a furlough in 2 or 3 years' time. No. They were swept off, they were hauled off into a pagan land by a pagan army, and there was no opportunity, as far as they ever knew when they were being swept off, that they would ever return to their land again. And they were brought into a land that was very different. What are some of those differences in the land of Babylon to the land of Judah? Well, the Babylonian landscape, for a start, was different. It was largely flat. Judah was a place of mountains. In fact, we have it in so many places in Scripture, Mount Zion, where the city of Jerusalem was built. And when the term Mount Zion is used, it's often referring to the city itself and not just to the mountain. So there's differences in the landscape. And Babylon had very long, hot summers and very short, cool winters. Two great rivers run through Babylon, Tigris and the Euphrates. And out of those two great rivers, many canals had been dug to fertilize and irrigate the land. And we have experiences of the people of God, isn't it? Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept. Then we get a picture of how painful it is. We wept. They wept by the rivers of Babylon. And Ezekiel sat with the exiles by the Kebar River, we read in the opening chapter of that great prophecy as well. The Kebar River was a canal, really, that joined the two great rivers together. It was a royal canal that was put there to irrigate the land and so on. And Judah was a land of hot and rainy seasons. See, it's the familiarity of something when it's not there anymore, you notice it. When something that you've hardly ever noticed, but then when it's taken from you or you're somewhere else, you suddenly realize this is very different. The food was different, and we'll come to that later. But the major, major, major difference, as I've already mentioned, is that Babylon was a pagan land. This is the ultimate major difference. It isn't simply the landscape, the language, and the culture that was around them in that sense, but it is that they were a pagan land. They did not worship the God of heaven. They did not worship Yahweh, the creator God. They did not recognize him. They worshiped their own gods. You notice there in verse 2 when it says that Nebuchadnezzar took off stuff from the Lord's temple. He put them in the temple of his own gods. In other words, by definition, a different God, not the God of the Israelites. Marduk was the god of the Babylonians, or Bel was the principal god of the Babylonians. And like all the other nations, they were polytheists. They worshipped many gods, different to the Israelites, who were monotheists, who worshipped one God, the God of heaven, the true God. Now, Isaiah himself had prophesied about the downfall of the gods of Babylon. long before the people of Israel were carried off into exile. And the reason he prophesied about the downfall of the gods of Babylon was so that when the people of Israel were in exile, they could draw hope from the prophecy that he had made. In Isaiah 46 and verses 1 and 2, he says, "Bel bows down, Nebo stoops, that idols are on beasts and livestock. Those things you carry are borne as burden on weary beasts. They stoop and bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into captivity." Now he's talking there about the fall of the Babylonian Empire, which we will get on to later on in this book, when it was replaced by the Persians and the Medes. And the problem for the Babylonians was they tried to rush off and save their gods. And these gods were such heavy, cumbersome figures that they actually slowed down the escape that the Babylonians were trying to make, and they were overrun. Now Daniel and his friends, they are among the few people of Judah in the first deportation who were taken away who were faithful to God. They were among the few that were godly. They were among the few that really worshipped the God of heaven. And they took into Babylon with them the promises of God. That promise that I've just quoted from Isaiah would have certainly been a promise that they would have carried into Babylon with them. And they would have thought through the promises and the teachings of God in that time of exile. Like the prophecy of Habakkuk that we looked at not so long ago. That was for the benefit of the people that would be in exile, so that they would know the will and the mind of God. So they were among the few Jews that really were faithful, who were carried off. They were among the few Jews who, while they were in Judah, really did love to go up to the temple and to the house of God. In Psalm 122, we speak about the people of God rejoicing, going up to the temple. Well, Daniel and his friends were that kind of people. And we know it as we go through this book that they were that kind of people. Now, that's a great Psalm, Psalm 122. And the old Scottish Psalter puts the opening verse, "I joyed when to the house of God go up, they said to me, Jerusalem, within thy gates our feet shall standing be." Of course, the heartbreak for Daniel and his friends were that when they were swept off, they in their hearts never knew whether their feet would ever again stand within the gates of Jerusalem. They never knew whether they would ever again stand within the gates of Jerusalem. And as they were being swept off, they possibly thought, this is the last that we're ever going to see of our homeland. They looked over their shoulder and they saw Jerusalem disappear into the background. And they saw it disappear and they walked. And as they walked and their feet eventually walked off the precious soil of the promised land. How painful that must have been for a faithful Jewish person who loved the Lord and knew that they were in the promised land and that God had given it to it. And then they are having to walk and leave behind the soil of the promised land that God had promised to them and the land that he had brought them into. And they walked and walked and walked until they walked their feet through the gates of Babylon. And as far as they knew, they would never see a Judean sunrise again or a Judean sunset. They would never see a Judean dry season or wet season again. They would never walk up again to the temple of the Lord. They would never again see the sacrifices on the blazing altar. They would never again see the high priest take the blood of the animal and disappear into the Holy of Holies to offer sacrifice for his own sin and for the sins of the people. Now, if you're a faithful Jew and you love the Lord, that is very, very painful. Never again would they hear the Levitical choir singing like a great orchestra at the temple. They were swept off and taken into a foreign land. And all the things that were precious to them was taken from them. And the heartbreak and the pain and the sorrow and the devastation was in front of them. You see, that is the heartbreak for the true Jew. The pain and the devastation of being relocated into a foreign land. There are the physical factors, there are the emotional factors, and there are the spiritual factors. How did they survive in that land? How did they manage to survive? Well, we'll go through the book and we'll see that. But clearly from the outset of the book, they buried themselves. They buried themselves in the promises and in the sovereignty of God. They buried themselves in the promises and in the sovereignty of God. And we touched on this a couple of weeks ago as I was setting out the themes for this book. And that's clear in verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, Nebuchadnezzar's hand, with some of the vessels of the house of God. The Lord gave Jehoiakim. So this is Daniel writing, trusting God's sovereignty. But actually, according to Hebrew scholars, what this verse has another part to it, or at least one more word, which the English doesn't translate. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of the gods. Of the house of the gods. There's a different article before gods. And the point is here that Daniel, who's writing this, is making clear that there's one true God. The God. There is no other God. Simply the God. Okay, well, let's move to our second point here. Daniel and his friends were faced with the challenge of a new identity while preserving their true identity. They're first of all faced with the challenge of being swept off or relocated into a foreign land. Now they are faced with the challenge of a new identity while preserving their true identity. Now that's the challenge that faces every Christian believer. Wherever you are, wherever we are as Christians, the challenge that faces us every day is to preserve our true identity as Christ, as the servants of God, whatever we are. Now Nebuchadnezzar was not just a great military commander, he was a great strategist. And when he came to Babylon, when it came to Babylonian long-term policy, he knew exactly what he was about. It wasn't simply that he just had some great military victories. He did have great military victories. But he had a very definite follow-on plan. He knew it was not simply enough to conquer a nation by force. But he also knew that you had to win the people after you conquered them by force. He had to win them over and to show them that the new life that they are now living isn't as bad as they think. That's his follow-on plan. The new life that you are now living is actually better than the life that you were living beforehand. And that's what he wants to show them. You see, people who are conquered by force are not a people who are going to be loyal. Conquer a people by force and they're not going to be loyal to you. They're going to resent you. They're going to be bitter towards you, and they're going to wait for an opportunity to strike back at you. He knows that. And the danger is, when you conquer people by force, that some key figures rise up amongst them, and people rally behind them, and you're going to have a lot of trouble to deal with. Now, Nebuchadnezzar couldn't allow that to happen, because the Babylonian Empire was spreading very quickly, and it was growing very quickly on the frontiers. And it was going to be a very costly business for him to have to send armies back to these places that he conquered to suppress the uprisings that would be taking place. It would be costly in manpower, it would be costly in time, and it would be costly in equipment and in provisions for that to suppress uprising rebellions. So Nebuchadnezzar's policy was conquer by force and then pacify the people that you have conquered. Conquer them by force and then pacify them. He did this in a number of ways, by making the existing king subject to him, or he removed him and replaced him with another king who would be loyal to him. And then he took off into the land the people that he could re-educate. The people that he could re-educate and retrain so that they would facilitate his follow-on plan. Now, how does he do that? He's no fool, this man here. He is in one sense, of course, but in another sense, he's wise according to the wisdom of the world. He himself was a king, and he was a royal prince. And having been a royal prince, he had all the privileges of good upbringing. He had all the privileges of a good education, and all the privileges of educating, training, that prepared him and made him the man that he was. We mustn't never just look at Nebuchadnezzar as a thug. He was a king, and he was a man that was over the army, and he was a royal prince, and a man that was well educated and prepared him for that position. And you see, sin is not simply an intellectual problem, but sin is a spiritual problem. But what people do with their intellect is they use it to advance their sin. And that's what this man here does. He's such a man that he takes his intellect and all his privileges and his ideas and his ambitions, and then he furthers his empire, which is built on sin, by putting into place these ideas that he has. Now, the people he took from Judah and all the other places of the world, they are to be reborn. They were to be reborn, and they were to be re-identified with the people of Babylon if they were going to facilitate his goals. And you notice there he tells Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, to bring in some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and nobility, youths without blemish, good appearance and skillful, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. He's very clear on what he wants to do here, this man. Well, he wants these men to facilitate his ongoing plan. And how are they going to do that? Well, he selects these men from different countries, and here it is from the country of Judah. And he wants those men to be re-educated, and he wants them to become the voice of Babylonian policy to their own people. He wants them to become the voice of Babylonian policy to his own people. It would be much easier for Nebuchadnezzar to send 3 or 4 Jewish men back to Jerusalem if there's an uprising, with a very strong message saying, look, Nebuchadnezzar says, toe the line or suffer the consequences. It would be much easier to do that than to send thousands of men up to Jerusalem. They're to be the voice of Babylonian policy. But as we have it, he did have to send his army up to Jerusalem 2 more times because of the uprisings and the rebellion against him in Jerusalem. Now, these men were also to be the voice for Nebuchadnezzar internally in Babylon to the Jewish community, just as those from the other nations were to be the voice to their people inside Babylon. Babylon, by this point, had huge quantities or population of foreign people living in the land. And that posed a danger internally and the danger of an external uprising against the empire as well. So by re-educating and retraining these young men, his plan is that they become the voice of Babylonian policy to pacify people who are angry and frustrated. Of course, King Pharaoh, didn't he? He had the same idea, but much different idea indeed. He wanted to pacify Jewish people, and he did it by killing the firstborn. And why did he do it? Because he said to his people, look, these Jews who are living among us, these Hebrews, are more numerous than we are ourselves. And if war breaks out, they will join our enemies. And there was a danger that they would be overrun. So he had an aggressive policy. But Nebuchadnezzar has an aggressive policy, conquer, followed by pacify. And his policy is conquer by force, then take the best people out of the land, re-educate them, and let them be the voice of Babylonian policy among their own people. Now, Daniel and his friends, they faced the challenge of Nebuchadnezzar's re-educating program. They faced this challenge here as well. They were taken into exile with a significant Jewish population in the first deportation, and then they were separated from their fellow Jews. These 4 men were separated from their fellow Jews to be used in the king's service. Okay? There were other men like Daniel and his friends who were godly men as well. And they would have met together to worship God and to spend time together and to encourage each other. And we know that this is true, because it's by the rivers of Babylon, says the psalmist, that we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. And that time for them would have been precious when they sat down together and when they spoke about the things of God and when they prayed together and when they discussed God's word, which would have included discussing the promises of deliverance in the future and so on. And there would have been clearly people there as well, without a doubt, who realized their error, who realized their sin, and why they had been taken into exile, and who would have repented of their sin and would have turned back to God. So all of these things would have been a great encouragement. But then these four men are suddenly wrenched not only from their homeland, but they're wrenched from the community of people that they are identifying with and who are gathering together to worship the Lord. Now, it's the king himself, you notice here, who gives the order to his chief official here that these men are to be brought in. And look at what he says about them in verse 4. Youths without blemish, good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, competent to stand before the kings in the king's palace. And to teach the language, the literature, sorry, and the language of the Chaldeans. And the king assigned to them a daily portion of food that the king ate and the wine that he drank. The king himself gives the order to re-educate these men. He's not a stupid man, Nebuchadnezzar. He knows what he's about here. And the king is looking for a certain kind of people. He's looking for a refined kind of people. Those of background, of status, of nobility. And there are other qualities. There are to be youths. Why youths? Because he wants men who are young men who are of a certain age, who can be taught, educated, and who will respect authority, seniority, and the discipline that's going to be put over them. He doesn't want strapping guys that are going to have a very laxed attitude towards it. He wants those that he can re-educate and break if he has to. And they're to be without blemish, in good appearance, skillful in wisdom and so on here, understanding and learning. You know, he has high ideals, doesn't he, Nebuchadnezzar? He wants even down to these men's features. They have to be of good appearance. He's very clear about who he wants to have around him, even physically around him. And here they're to be educated here. And we know as we go on, it's for 3 years as we look on the other part of this passage. Now this is what we might refer to as a university, the privilege of a university education. These men are really, truly being educated. This is a high level of education that they're being given. But it is not simply academia that Nebuchadnezzar is interested in here. What he's interested in is transformation. What he's really interested in is to transform the thinking of these men. What he's really interested in is to give them a new world view. And that would involve learning the wisdom, the culture, the religion of the Babylonians. And that would have been passed on by those who studied it from the higher classes and preserved it and so on. There's a challenge there for us. We need to be very careful ourselves at what we're reading, the kind of things that we're sucking in. I think we should read the things of the world that are around us from an objective perspective, coming and looking at them and knowing that what we're reading is something that we don't agree with, but we're reading it to educate ourselves with certain things so that we can respond well to those that are in those communities or those who have those mindsets. But we need to be very careful. Many Christians get very fascinated with different things, and they take on board a lot of different things from the world. And before they know it, it does a lot of damage to them. And even in Christian ministries, men have been derailed by the philosophy and the wisdom of the world around them. And then you start to see that coming out. Paul spoke about those who had their faith shipwrecked. Among them are Hymenaeus and Alexander, he says, in 1 Timothy 1:19. Now, the new identities that Nebuchadnezzar was carving out for Daniel and his friends also involved a change of diet. Now, we'll come and look at that next time, when we're back at this the next time. I will deal with that next time on its own. But it's enough to say for now, what Nebuchadnezzar was saying was, you're in Babylon now. And while you're in Babylon, eat, drink, and be merry. Do as the Babylonians do. And they also needed a new identity needs a new name. So this is a complete change for these men. They're to be re-educated, they're going to have a new diet, and they're going to have new names. Now, the name Daniel means God is judge. Hananiah means Yahweh is gracious. Mishael means who is what God is. And Azariah means Yahweh has helped or will help. Now, these are wonderful Jewish names, and like many, many other Jewish names like them, They convey truths about God. They convey truths about God's character, and they convey truths about God's attributes. And the new names that these men are given are Babylonian names. And what these Babylonian names are conveying is things about the gods of Babylon. Things about the gods of Babylon that refers to the gods of Babylon. Now we get the sense here that Nebuchadnezzar is a man that knows what he's about. In military terms, he takes. And then afterwards he has a follow-on plan to secure the success of the Babylonian Empire. He needs to re-educate and retrain people that will walk in his ways. That's what he's really looking for. While the Bible says that we should walk in God's ways, Nebuchadnezzar is really looking for men that can be re-educated and retrained that will walk in his ways. And of course, in Scripture, Babylon is such a symbolic picture of this world and all that evil is and all that evil stands for. That's seen in the book of Zechariah when the woman in the basket is carried off into Babylon, and it's in that vision, and she's referred to as wickedness. And then in Revelation as well, we come upon Babylon again, which is a picture of this world that we're living in. But we also get the sense that he's not only simply trying to maintain the Babylonian Empire, but he's also a vain man. He's a vain man. And this becomes clear in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30, when Nebuchadnezzar, standing on the roof of his great palace, and he says, he's looking out over Babylon, and he says, "Is this not the royal Babylon I have built with my own might and power?" And it's when he says that that he's struck down, and we'll come to that. So he's a vain man. He looks over all that he's conquered in a military sense, and then he looks at all the peoples that he has re-educated and retrained to be Babylonians, and he congratulates himself. And he does that in the light of the fact, as we will see in the next chapters, that God has already been breaking into his life and telling him very clearly that all he has comes under the sovereign hand and working of God. And yet he still says, "Is this not the great Babylon that I have built?" And God strikes him down. Now, we're always talking to people about the danger of being taken out of fellowship with God's people, or the danger of not being regularly attending fellowship with God's people because of the negative impact that it has on us. And that is indeed very true. And we warn people not to take for granted the fellowship that we have as God's people together. The time that we have as God's people in fellowship is precious and it's sacred, and we should make the full use of that. We shouldn't have a policy attitude, "I'll drift in, drift out, see if I can make it." And those who have that attitude suffer spiritually. But here in Daniel's case, and in the case of his friends, they were separated from the fellowship of God's people against their will. They were separated from the fellowship of God's people against their will. And yet this did not destroy their faith. It actually brought out their faith. Now that's a great challenge for us, because what these young men had sown into their hearts and into their souls could not be taken out by the re-educating program of this king of Babylon. You see, those who are denied the treasures of God, the precious things of God, tend to love the things of God. They tend to love them more, because they realize how rich and how precious they are. They tend to love the things of God. And this marks out the character of those four men throughout this book. They've been separated, and yet they're so faithful to God. Now that's a great challenge for us. Are we people who treasure the things of God? If we were separated from the things of God, would we simply become Babylonians? If we were separated from the things of God and we were among other people all the time, would our character still shine as a people that belong to God? Or would we be absolutely no different to those that we spend time with? Now that's an everyday thing. We're in different places. You're in a workplace. You're in different places. You meet people that aren't Christians all the time. What are you like when you're spending time at work? And what are you like when you're spending time with people that aren't Christians? Do they know that you're a Christian? Do the people that you work with that aren't Christians know that you're a Christian? And do the people that you spend time with that aren't Christians, do they know that you're a Christian? Would we simply become Babylonians? Well, that's what happened to many of the Jews. They simply became Babylonians. And many of them were taken off to Babylon under the judgment of God because they were already Babylonian in their heart. They didn't care about the things of God. The temple meant nothing to them. The sacrifices meant nothing to them. The laws of God meant nothing to them. And that's why they were in Babylon. But for a man like Daniel and his friends, the things of God meant everything to them. And they could be separated from the fellowship, but they could not be separated from God. They still had each other, of course. And they were able to find refreshment in each other. And they were able to encourage each other. Well, let me just sum up here with a couple of things from Psalm 137, that great psalm which speaks about this time of exile. And there's a great question in that psalm. And it says this: how shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? It's a really despairing question, isn't it? How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? But then the response to that question comes in the same psalm. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Here was a man who was a musician. Let my right hand forget its skill if I forget you, O Jerusalem. Here was a man that sung to God as well, because he says, let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. You see, that's Daniel's attitude, and that's the attitude of his friends here. And the identification with Jerusalem there is not simply one geographically, but it is a spiritual identification with Jerusalem. Well, who do we identify with? Do we identify with the people around us, the culture around us, or do we identify with the spiritual Jerusalem? Well, may God bless his word to us, and to him be the praise and indeed the glory.